Good afternoon, everyone, members and observers of the Standing Advisory Group. Also welcome to members of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and also others observing our meeting here in person and also on the webcast. As I'm sure you know, Tom Ray, the PCOB Chief Auditor, typically chairs the meetings of the Standing Advisory Group. Unfortunately for this meeting, Tom is unable to be here. However, he has asked Greg Skates and I to chair this meeting on his behalf, and we are happy to do so. We have several topics on the agenda this afternoon and also tomorrow, which we are interested in obtaining your feedback. Today, we'll discuss two topics, the first being audit considerations in the current economic environment, and the second is feasibility of audit indicators, audit quality indicators.
Ask for a point of personal privilege. Okay. I'm sorry, but this is Steve Harris. It's our first meeting to the SAG, and he's heard a lot about it from the time he got here. Steve is a new board member. Took the seat that Kayla Gillen had. Steve and I have known each other for a long time, and we've had the opportunity to work together when we were both in the working for the Senate Banking Committee, Steve on one side of the aisle and I on the other. And Steve already has shown us that he's going to make a very important contribution to the SAG. So, Steve, welcome him.
No problem. I guess I'm not doing a good job so far in my first 5 minutes. I don't know. Thank you. As I was saying, today we will talk about two topics, and tomorrow we have three. We'll continue our discussion on audit quality indicators. We'll talk about the signing of the auditor's report, and then we'll conclude our meeting tomorrow with a discussion on our proposed standard-setting activities. Before we get into the agenda topics, there is a housekeeping item which I need to remind everyone of, and those relate to the club's rules, the rules of the Army-Navy Club. Here, they ask that all of us respect two of those rules. One is that men, and this applies to men and not women, but men, if you leave this room and go into the common areas, that you have your jackets on. And the second applies to everyone is they do not want us to use cell phones in this building. So you must leave the building if you need to use your phone, make a phone call. So I request that you respect the rules of the Army-Navy Club in that regard. I'd like to move on to our emerging issue discussion. Obviously, there's much in the press and there's much happening every day with respect to the current economic environment. Many of our focus has been on what's happening with us personally and our own personal accounts, but in our view at the PCOB, our mission is regards to the auditors. And so we've been giving some thought and are interested today in feedback from the members of the Standing Advisory Group on how this economic environment affects auditors and also has an impact, or what impact does it have in connection with upcoming audits of public companies. I've asked Marty Baumann to join me in this discussion today. Marty Baumann, as I think all of you know, is the PCOB Director of Research and Analysis. Marty leads that group, and his group is focused on risk, and his group provides feedback to all areas of the PCOB, including inspections, standards, as well as others. I've asked Marty to share, because of his focus on risk and the economic environment, asked him to share his views on how risk may impact auditors in the upcoming audits to help tee up this discussion. So, Marty.
Thank you, Jennifer, for that introduction. And good afternoon, everybody. I speak to auditors in a variety of forums, and certainly for the past, going well into 2007 and certainly all of 2008, in any speech before any audit group, have told them that I think they're dealing in one of the most challenging audit environments that I can remember. And I had been an auditor for 33 years before my most recent job. So this is an extraordinarily difficult time, I think, for many people, for the economy, for preparers of financial statements, but certainly for auditors. So today we wanted to talk to the Standing Advisory Group about the current economic crisis. And we're going to talk, quite frankly, very little, because we want your input. And after I talk for just a few moments, we'll put up a few questions. But really, the big question would be, what do you think we ought to be doing in terms of giving guidance, if anything, to auditors in this environment? Well over a year ago, I sat here at the table and talked about the subprime mortgage crisis and the developments for financial institutions and problems they were seeing in subprime. And we talked a little bit about how that might emerge into something broader at this table, some of you may recall. In December of 2007, PCAOB issued practice alert number 2, dealing with the auditing of fair value measurements and the use of specialists. And practice alert 2 didn't issue new audit guidance, but it reminded auditors of their responsibilities regarding fair value measurements and pointed out pulled together all of the auditing standards into one cohesive place and linked them together with some of the accounting guidance. And one important point it made was if auditors were getting quotes from brokers or pricing services and they were neither a bid to purchase securities nor based on active trades, but instead the broker or pricing service model, that we thought auditors under existing rules needed to understand the inputs to those models. And things like that, I think, have been an important matter for auditors as they've struggled through the auditing of fair value. It's been a difficult time in 2007 and into 2008. But as it's not hard to observe that there continue to be challenges in financial institutions. Obviously, with measuring fair value, the SEC and the FASB came out with a joint press release recently. The FASB came out with an FSP amending FAS 157 by putting in an example with respect to measuring fair value in illiquid markets. That fair value itself continues to be a challenge. But other areas within financial institutions certainly have raised their head recently, including credit default swaps and derivatives. Certainly the allowance for loan losses in financial institutions would be a complex area. Can you forward that slide, Jennifer? So another subject is other than temporary impairment. Other than temporary impairment is interesting. It's one of the most principles-based of the accounting standards that we have, and certainly it's one that's being debated quite a lot today by both preparers, auditors, and regulators in terms of how to interpret other than temporary impairment in today's times. There certainly are a lot of securities that are underwater for an extended period of time, and interpreting the principles-based guidance around that has been a challenge for both preparers and auditors. But beyond financial institutions, and this is a little bit about what we want to talk about today or hear from you, there are issues that are the fallout from the credit crisis. Questions emerge as to responsibilities of auditors to express a going concern opinion if it appears that the company is experiencing difficulties and may not be able to operate for the next cycle, usually considered to be 1 year in terms of the existing auditing standards. It's worth pointing out that the FASB has recently issued proposed guidance for preparers regarding going concern considerations. Going concern has traditionally been an area only in the auditing literature and not part of generally accepted accounting principles. Other areas that you might consider with respect to audit challenges, and you get beyond the fact that this was initially a subprime crisis and then it's extended into collateralized debt obligations and probably many of the securities and assets on the banks and financial institutions' balance sheets, but the impact is now certainly gone. The fallout is into other industries. Whether or not we're in a recession is not a debate for this group, but many say that retailers could have a sluggish season in 2008 and a variety of industries in manufacturing are reporting difficulties as well. If that's the case, going concern might be a bigger challenge for auditors at the end of 08 than it even was in 07. And then other areas such as the ones listed here, pensions. S&P 500 companies overall were overfunded maybe a year ago, but as I read, are now overall underfunded in their pension plans. Pension plans have important considerations that have to be taken into account, such as discount rate and expected return on plan assets, and expected returns could be a challenging assumption for both preparers and auditors in the context of the preparation of the current year's financial statements. Receivables of all types, whether it's a retailer's receivable or in manufacturing, we've observed some statistics in a variety of places and industries which have indicated days sales outstanding growing as well. So an increasing audit risk around receivables. Inventories, whether the retailers or manufacturers, have to be carried at lower of cost or market. And fair value, of course, being determined these days under FAS 157. But again, with potentially shelves with more inventory than expected and sales less than expected, reporting inventories at lower of cost or market could be challenging areas. Other areas of asset impairments include other variety of long-lived assets, including goodwill. With acquisitions that have been done in the past years, one just has to look at the stock prices today and indicate that values certainly have decreased, and might wonder whether expectations as to the realizability of what the cash flows were at the time of purchase are the same as those might be in today's environment. And so taking a look at goodwill, other amortizable intangibles, and other long-lived assets could present challenging areas. Deferred taxes, an environment in which companies are reporting losses exposed to future losses may indicate a need for a valuation reserve for deferred taxes under Statement 109, which indicates that a valuation allowance should be sufficient to reduce the deferred tax asset to an amount that is more likely than not to be realized. So really, just I sort of talked down the left-hand side of the balance sheet and said, maybe not just for financial institutions, but for industries in general, there could be a variety of issues with respect to the left-hand side of the balance sheet and valuations. And then, of course, there's importance of disclosures. There's many we could have talked about, but let's just take SOP 94-6, for example, disclosure of certain risks and uncertainties. This is maybe a period of time where disclosures of risks and uncertainties might be very, very important for a variety of companies to put in their financial statements, and auditors may feel like those would be essential items. So at this point in time, really what we want to do, Jennifer, is I think tee up a couple of questions, I think, on the next slide. Mm-hmm. And I guess the first set of questions we have is, do these areas present specific challenges in the current economic environment, and do you believe there are any additional areas relevant to consider? And what are the areas identified are most likely to be significant? So that's the first question we'd like to open with to the group and get your input on these other audit risks that you might see emerging as part of this current economic crisis. Thank you.
Galen Hansen.
Thank you, Marty, and I really do want to thank the staff of the PCOB, and on behalf of all the SAG members, I'm sure we would say the same thing to Tom. We're going to miss him here today. Marty, I do remember a year ago when we talked about the subprime, and it was a big deal, and I remember that alert that came out. Even prior to that, the Center for Audit Quality issued an alert 207-51, a white paper on measurements of fair value in illiquid markets. And I, going back into what they said, and if I might just quote very briefly, it is not unreasonable to expect, especially for subprime mortgage-related assets, that current conditions could persist for an extended period of time until uncertainty reduced when it will become clear that defaults have peaked and real estate prices have bottomed out. Well, that was a year ago, and yet even today I'm seeing that a major bank has recorded a $19 billion goodwill write-down. And from what I've been reading, we're seeing banks that their trading prices are significantly less than what their book values are. So the question is begged, you know, how much more is there out there, and what does this mean for auditors, which I think is what our question is. And I think, you know, in my mind, the question has to be raised, where were the auditors, and why weren't there some early warnings on this? What about SOP 94-6? And why isn't 94-6? Why does that seem to be such a difficult thing to be able to put it on the table and alert the public as to what has been happening? I would hope that would be part of our discussion today. It seems to me that there should have been some indication as to what was out there and whether or not these companies could weather the storm. And perhaps 94-6, and that's an accounting question, needs to be expanded, but are the auditors doing what they need to do to make sure that that's being followed by the companies? Thank you.
Thank you, Galen. Joe Carcello.
Thank you, Jennifer. Let me try to directly respond to the questions here. In terms of areas that present specific audit challenges in the current environment, when I read the briefing paper before I got too far into it, I thought I didn't want to be biased, so I wrote down areas that I thought would be potentially problematic, and I think the list, Marty, I guess your group has developed, is pretty good. Had most of the things I had thought of. I'll throw a few others out there for you to think about. On the financial statement side, I think one thing you might want to consider is contingencies. There's going to be a lot of lawsuits, and there's also some guarantees that are out there that are potentially problematic. I guess it's FIN 45, so you probably want to think about that. You might want to think about FIN 46R, because some of these vehicles that have been set up to house this paper have been set up off the balance sheet and are being pulled back onto the balance sheet, and so you might want to think about issues surrounding that. And then FAS 123R on stock-based compensation, probably the most important determinant of the value of the option is the volatility. What do you use as a volatility measure now? And that's going to be, I think, a challenge. I don't have the answer, but I think it's going to be a challenge. Then everything you had up there, Marty, strikes me as financial statement focused, which is certainly appropriate. But I also thought about internal control over financial reporting. So I had a couple of thoughts as it relates to that. One would be disclosure failures in the MD&A, other parts of the 10-K, and the proxy, to the extent that they exist. What does this tell you about the control environment, information and communication, and monitoring? So although the auditor is not necessarily auditing those things, the auditor is at least reading the 10-K, and to the extent there are issues there, I think that's a signal about certain aspects of the control environment, which the auditor is auditing as part of ICFR. The other thing is, do financial institutions have a material weakness in internal control due to problems with the risk assessment component of internal control? A lot of people would say, as it relates to risk assessment, a number of the financial institutions have clearly failed. So what does that tell us, if anything, about internal control? So at least those are things to think about.
Yeah, those are all good things, and thank you for that contribution, Joe.
Greg Jonas.
Thanks, Jennifer. Comments on one of the items, Marty, that you mentioned, and then let me add five to the list. First comment on the list, it strikes me as a very reasonable list. Regarding going concern, you know, I don't think we're very good as auditors of flagging going concerns. I think when an auditor says there's substantial doubt about a going continuing as a going concern. What the auditor means is it's almost certain that the company is going to go bankrupt. If you look at companies that have gone bankrupt and ask what percentage of the time does the auditor flag going concern in the year prior to that, you find out our track record's about 50 cents on the dollar, if I remember the academic research. So we're not all that good at this, and of course we're going into a period of time when there's going to be many companies, unfortunately, that face this prospect. So perhaps some guidance to auditors about looking at outside signals about going concerns, market prices, credit default swap prices, for example. There are some indicators that auditors could look to that might help. I think the biggest problem, though, we have with going concern is that the market has come to be trained to think that going concern means for sure that it's going to go down, and so there's a real bias on the auditor to not pull that trigger unless they're absolutely certain, because companies tell them, my God, if you say this, it's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy because of the way the market interprets it. So I think we have a problem in the way we apply going concern, and at the same time, I think it's an important thing to signal when there's a pending problem, and we should pull the trigger more often than we do. Very quickly, the five things that I would add is, number one, I think in this environment there is a heightened risk of senior management cooking the books. You know, the fraud risk triangle has got, opportunity, pressure, and integrity, and of course the pressure is going to be enormous on people. We're talking about careers and families, and it's tough, and the temptation is growing, and I think we need to be ever vigilant about that. My second addition relates to revenue recognition. In my experience, when things get tight, companies still want to do business, customers still want to buy, but the customer may not be able to pay in cold hard cash as they had done before, and so the two parties get creative, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but economically they get creative as to how to do business but not transact in cash. And whenever that happens, it can raise complex issues. And, you know, we just need to keep our mind on what the rules are. And the rules are complex, but oftentimes don't allow revenue recognition for all or part of the transaction when the parties get creative about how to do business even when cash is tight. My third addition relates to contractual triggers littered throughout contracts, obviously, including debt agreements. There are often triggers based on market prices or credit ratings or any myriad of things, and it's always amazing that, you know, what's in the small print of these contracts, and it's not until times get tough that these things go off like little bombs, and it kind of surprises people. So it might be a good time to read the details of these contracts and really try to flag what are the relevant triggers. The next one on my list is restructuring. I think there's going to be a lot of that, and I think I know as users, I think many of us users are confused about how companies report restructurings these days. My sense is that some accountants and auditors are also need to be reminded about what those rules are, and because there's going to be a lot of it going on, and we need to be good at reporting restructurings. Do so under the rules. And then finally, my final item, and then I promise to be quiet here, is liquidity. I recognize that there is not a footnote in the financials on liquidity, although some of them bang up against this, but there certainly is a lot of this in MD&A, and I know auditors aren't auditing MD&A, but we need to read the disclosures and make sure they're consistent with our understanding. And, you know, liquidity is just an enormous issue these days for companies. And so spending time thinking hard and long about, you know, the SEC has excellent guidance, I think, now in their MD&A rules about liquidity. And it's really important that companies and auditors can help companies get the complete story out on the table. Thank you.
Greg, thanks for the list. I just wanted to check something with you. And when you commented on restructurings, were you including a risk of a potential big bath type write-offs given the fact that losses are expected anyway?
Yeah. Under the restructuring rules, of course, Marty, there's less opportunity to take a big bath through restructuring. You kind of got to wait these days until things occur. But certainly, you know, the big bath risk is a risk. That isn't the one that I had in mind, though, but now that you mention it, it's certainly a risk.
I was linking it into your earlier comment on financial fraud. So.
Thank you. Vin Coleman.
I think the list is pretty good. You know, in our firm, we try to go through and the additions. You know, we've been messaging a lot of these areas. But the one area that we've messaged pretty heavily that's not included here is more from a governance standpoint. So what should the communications to the audit committee be? And to go through the various risks and understanding. So to Greg's point that he just made, talk about the liquidity and maybe communications with the rating agencies as an example, and the sensitivity of the rating agencies, whether it's in the audit committee or the finance committee, or that type of oversight and communication that everybody really understands the risk assessment, the changes in the risk assessment being communicated based on current events, because it's been very, very fluid. So if you were to give an audit committee an audit plan back in the spring, I would assert to you that there's been quite a few changes, you know, perhaps as you're going into, you know, your year-end phase. And that seems to be, this seems to be much more accounting-driven, which is fair, but I think there should be some governance drive, too, in your consideration.
Thanks, Ben. Joe, did you have your card up again, or is that from before? Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to add something to what Greg said. I thought what Greg said was very good, but I wanted to maybe just clarify one thing, because he did refer to the academic literature, and he pointed out that, I think he said 50% on the dollar, that auditors only issue a going concern about half the time before a company goes bankrupt within the next year, and that's not so good. One, if you become interested in this topic and you want to actually look at something that might be helpful, there's a pretty seminal paper in the late 90s, I believe it was 1998, published in the Journal of Accounting Research by Jane Mutchler, Jim McCune, and Anthony Hopwood. And they basically, the argument has been made that models out-predict auditors in predicting going concern. And so they make the argument, if that's true, then auditors would be pretty irrational not to use those models. And so that doesn't seem very likely, given the economic incentives that auditors have to get it right. And so they make a number of essentially technical and econometric adjustments and relook at the question. And what they find is that the auditor is as good, if not better, than any model in predicting going concern. So I don't disagree with what you've said, Greg, but it's just really hard to do well. And it's not obvious that we have a mechanical model that can do better. And if anything, the evidence seems to suggest that the auditors are probably better than the models we have right now.
Thanks, Joe. Bob Tarola.
Thanks, Jennifer. I think the list is fine, and especially as supplemented by those who have spoken before me. What I'd like to suggest is, though, that the auditing profession take a leadership role in communicating the risks that they will be focusing on over the next cycle, as opposed to let companies maybe haphazardly deal with them on their own. I think the auditing profession is condensed relative to public companies in a relatively I think focused way. Information can get out into the marketplace as to what risks will be addressed, what would be expected of preparers, so that there's a clear expectation within the marketplace and among companies and auditors of how the current economic situation will be dealt with in financial reporting.
Thanks, Bob. Well, I guess, Bob, in your to kind of respond to your remark or comment on it, you suggested the auditing profession provide some type of guidance. Our next question up here is a question related to, should the PCAOB issue additional guidance? So in connection with your comment, you know, would like feedback, in that point, should it be the auditing profession? Would it be helpful for the PCAOB to issue additional guidance to all auditors? So, just keep that in mind as well. Lynn Turner?
To your last question there, I do think someone needs to put out something. The AICPA has done a good job in the past of putting out their annual audit risk alerts, and I think something coming out of the board or the staff of the board in that regards would be most helpful, focusing on the things that you and others have already laid out. So I think putting that out in black and white, because I think that also helps companies, because if you put it out and companies are aware that it's out there, then they know the things to focus on. They can focus on them at the same time the auditors are. And I think that'll help out everyone sitting around the table in those conversations then. So I'd certainly encourage the board to turn around and consider putting out some guidance on the issues that you've talked about. Having gone through these type of situations before, though, I think there's some overarching things that you need to think about as you put out that guidance. I think Marty mentioned the issues with pensions and inventory, and Joe mentioned the issues with 123 and the valuation. In general, when we have a recession like we're heading into, people have a very difficult time making that adjustment. They tend to look at the historical trends up to where we're at and forget that we're going through a major shift and fundamental shift, and what's been there in the past is no longer what's going to be there in the future going forward. So I think you need to emphasize that they almost have to throw out historical trends here and start looking at what's really happening on a real active real-time basis. Because one of the biggest impacts is we're already seeing companies' revenues are going to slow down significantly, companies' cash flows are going to slow down, and the profits are going to decline significantly from where they've been in the past as spending comes to a halt. And that means, the goodwill stuff, as you mentioned, is back on the table, the value of the assets, the inventory, whether or not you get collectability on the receivables. If you reserve 2% in the past, that's not necessarily going to work anymore going forward. And so people really need to be thinking about what's changing here on a quarter-by-quarter basis. This can't be something that you just audit at the end of the year either. You've got to really be looking at this throughout the year, both companies and the auditors. I've recently gone through some filings, and it's just amazing to see differences in what's going on with the reserves and all, through the first three quarters of the year, and then you get down to that fourth year quarter again. And thank God for the auditors in the fourth quarter, we probably wouldn't have even gotten that. But I do think some of that needs to be advised. The other thing is, we get into this, someone mentioned our responsibility as auditors to read the entire document. And this really ties into what the SEC does with MD&A and the importance of that piece of it. And we're going to have, again, some fundamental resets here, and there needs to be, the auditor needs to read that, and they need to read it with some integrity, and if they don't believe what's in there, then they need to do something about it. Too often we've seen auditors read MD&A. While they aren't auditing it, they almost are willing to give it a pass because their name isn't going on it. But that's not what SAS 8 says. SAS 8 says if you read it and you see something that's not correct in there, then you need to first of all go tell the audit committee about it, that it needs to change. And I think there needs to be some impetus on this, and back to the role of the auditor communicating with the audit committee. If they see something in there that they don't like, they can't just sit on it. They got to turn around and actually do something with it. Someone else mentioned the internal control area as well. I'm amazed that to date we've seen almost no weaknesses on internal controls and credit derivatives, despite the problem that they've created and the inability of people even to get good disclosures. We're seeing scenarios, we've certainly seen one that's been in the press a tad bit lately, where literally just a phenomenal impact, and yet if you go through those filings, you can't pull that impact out at all in a SOP 94-6. So either SOP 94-6 isn't working, or the companies aren't getting the disclosures and auditors are giving them a pass. But we are not getting, despite all this reports that we got a calamity on our hands. We're not getting anything out of these companies in the footnotes saying we got a calamity on your hands, right up to the point of where within a month or two they got to go borrow over $100 billion from the government. No indication that that is just around the corner. And it really begs the question is, if the auditors are on top of it and all, why isn't that getting into the disclosures under SAS 8 or otherwise? So I turn around and say, your list is pretty good, but there's some of those other things that you need to keep in mind as well.
One of our questions relates to, we had 10 things on our list, I think that was a count, and I'm hearing almost about 10 more. And thinking about whether or not we should issue guidance or what areas, are there any areas, that, our second question up here is, are most, you know, likely to be most significant? And maybe the answer is it depends, but kind of based on the list of things that we had on there plus other things that people have mentioned, or you know, interested in feedback or thoughts about any in particular that are more significant than others. Barbara Broker?
My comment is slightly sort of higher level since I don't know the details the way the rest of you do, but one of the things that concerns me most about the situation we find ourselves in is that we are entering this period of intense pressure after we have spent several years beating up on auditors for doing too much on internal controls and beating up on the PCAOB for doing too much on the standards for auditing internal controls, where the entire message has been we need to back down and back off. We're seeing the same kind of political pressure being brought to bear on fair value accounting. And I would just say that it is extraordinarily important if the auditors are going to be in the position of having to draw a tough line on some of these issues with their clients, that they have the backing of the board in the tone that it takes in talking about these issues, and that we don't send a subtle message or not so subtle message that auditors need to ease off and be a little more flexible and help everybody get through it, because that kind of message, which we've heard a lot of in recent years, I think is going to really undermine the ability for auditors to play the role they need to do in this environment.
Thanks, Barbara. Chuck Noski.
Noski, thank you. I find myself in the awkward position of agreeing with Lynn Turner, which is not frequent. But one of the things that I've heard a number of comments about what audit committees do or don't do around this issue, and I serve on and chair two audit committees. And one thing I know that management and audit committees are spending a lot of time on during in trying to address the difficulties in this current economic environment is within the context of the enterprise risk management frameworks. And companies spend an awful lot of time on it. I've been struck by how little time or attention is given by the independent auditors to the company's efforts in those areas. And of course, it's more than just financial reporting. It's operational, it's strategic, it's legal and compliance. But as you think about the kinds of disclosures that should either be in the MD&A or in the financial statements with respect to risk, auditors may want to think about taking a look at what managements are discussing and thinking about and responding to in their enterprise risk management framework. For example, in the companies I'm involved in, they're looking pretty holistically at the impact of the credit crisis, not only all of the things on your list, which I'll characterize as sort of balance sheet oriented, receivables, inventories, pension liabilities, and the like. They're also looking at the second order impacts of the credit crisis, things that might affect their vendors or suppliers or participants in their distribution channel. For example, if there are distributors between the company and the end customer, if those distributors have financial problems or access to credit problems, that's not going to necessarily show up in your financial statements, but the ability to continue to operate your business and generate revenues at the levels that you have historically generated at will be impaired. And that perhaps would be one example. So these second-order issues, if you're an oil and gas company, for example, and you're building a large capital project, They have typically viewed these projects that even if the operator goes into bankruptcy, for example, steel companies and things like that, they'll continue to operate. Well, if the project doesn't get finished because your partner has credit access problems, either you, the company, are going to put more money in, or you're going to have a dead asset sitting there, and then you're going to face an devaluation and other kinds of risks. And so I would just encourage you, as you think about the type of guidance that you provide to auditors, that they perhaps want to get a bit more involved in understanding what companies are doing in the ERM area and what the implications are to disclosures, and then to think about the second and third order impacts that may not be quite so apparent as the ones on your list. Thank you.
Thank you.